The world's best don't get results alone, and now neither do you, no matter when, where, or what you're working on. Introducing Pit Stop's AI Avatar Marketplace. Think of it like Spotify, but for personal and professional growth. Imagine instant access to digital versions of the world's top coaches, each one trained on their unique methods, experience, and coaching style. This isn't just another chatbot. Every Pit Stop AI avatar is powered by real coach insights, their notes, their podcasts, and what they've learned from real sessions. It's a truly personalized coaching companion, so much smarter and more relevant than generic tools like ChatGPT. Whether you want to level up in business, build new habits, manage stress, or boost your confidence, you're not just getting advice, you're getting it directly from the playbook of proven high achievers, all at a fraction of the cost of traditional coaching and available 24/7 whenever you need that extra edge. Ready to find the coach that you need? Use Pit Stop as your launchpad for growth. Head to the link in the show notes and download the app now.
Welcome to Drive to Thrive, a Pit Stop podcast. My name is Sandy and I am your host. And this is not about 3-hour discussions of unrealistic protocols, impossible to manage morning routines, and all that stuff that you hear on so many of these podcasts. Instead, the idea behind this is we bring you real conversations with experts, professionals, but also everyday men who are just looking to improve and get better one day at a time. Our goal is to offer realistic, tangible, relatable advice to help you navigate and ultimately thrive in all aspects of life, no matter where you are. So I hope that you guys get comfortable and enjoy the show. And joining me on the podcast this week are Fabian Devlin and Patrick Addis, the co-authors of the amazing book, Big Boys Don't Cry, a self-help men's mental health book with 60 stories by men and partners of men who share their real lived experiences and give advice to other men. In the episode, we discussed all aspects of mental health, how to deal with anxiety and depression, strategies to improve everyday life, the stigma around medication to treat mental illness, and the idea of realizing your own insignificance and how that can help. And of course, an awful lot more. So please do enjoy my conversation with Fabian and Patrick. Fabian, Patrick, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast. Great to have you guys here.
Pleasure. Good to be here.
Pleasure. Something that really struck me immediately when taking a look at the book, and one of the first things that you guys said was this concept of manning up and the dangers behind that. And I love something that you said, as part of that was the idea of opening up instead of manning up. I mean, Fabian, maybe you can kick off. What are your thoughts behind that, and why do you think the idea of manning up is so dangerous?
Yeah, it's a real bugbear of mine, actually, this kind of manning up. I find it really dismissive and quite dangerous, actually. And it kind of ties into, you know, when Patrick came to me, first of all, and had this idea for this book with this Big Boys Don't Cry. And it kind of falls into that kind of trope of, you know, these things that get bandied around probably when you're growing up, you know, man up, grow a pair, you know, big boys don't cry, wet ghost blouse, all those kind of things we would have heard. And so for me, what this book is really the antithesis of that, actually, is actually people not manning up. It's being actually more stronger, I think, than that. Actually, manning up and being quiet is probably the easier option. It's harder to show that vulnerability. And I think that's what we agreed that we wanted to do as part of this book.
I can only second that. Fabian is very good at these, summing things up well. So I totally agree with what he has to say basically on that. I do think, I said this to someone recently, like there was someone who was trying to say, let's try and get a forum at my work actually for men to open up about mental health. I said, look, I think personally you have to do things with men. Do active things, and then men tend to open up. If you just want to sit someone down in the room and get all their, you know, darkest secrets and all their mental health problems, probably isn't going to be that effective with most men, unless you've done something together first to bond, and then men can be quite open, I think.
That is picking up on that. I think that's really interesting because there are organisations like kind of men's sheds, for example, where you actually do something quite practical in something DIY, and then that conversation comes up alongside that. Patrick's really into sport, so again, sport might be a way into do that as well. But something that you and Emmett talked about in a previous podcast, Sandy, was about this kind of thing of modeling, actually, and having that it only takes one conversation. And I think Patrick and I are now having a much deeper, kind of richer, you know, friendship, really, because we give to each other when we are having difficulty, don't we, Pat?
We did. We went to school together and we used to play table tennis together in our gap year when we're doing very badly paid jobs. And little were we to know then that 10 or so, 15 years later, we'd be suffering, you know, from our own mental health issues, probably stemming from, well, definitely for me, from work, and maybe Fabian as well, from the pressures of adult life when we're these 19-year-olds hitting table tennis balls around, living at home. The whole world's our oyster, but the reality of real life as you're an adult is quite tough. And I think, yeah, that we look back and laugh sometimes about the table tennis days, happiest times of our lives, but future brings responsibility, brings families, brings mortgages, brings all those things and pressure that you don't know as a 19-year-old you're going to have to face, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of those things it's come down to. It's the idea of like there's so many things that men need to kind of live up to now across all aspects of our lives. You know, you need to be in great shape. You need to look great in the mirror. You need to be earning loads of money. You need to have a great career. You need to be providing for everyone else. But you also need to be finding time to do the things you love and be happy and be outgoing and confident. And actually, often I think, well, what we've all found as men living in today's world is as soon as you kind of focus on one and optimize one, often it's at the sacrifice of a couple of those other aspects, isn't it? And that's when I think these mental health issues start to come through, don't they? You know, you realize I've put all this time into my job and work, and actually now my relationships and my health are suffering for it, or the vice versa of I put all this time into my health or whatever it is, but actually I'm struggling to pay the rent. And then that leads to, you know, anxiety and things. So it's so difficult, isn't it, to try and find that balance across all aspects, really, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a real balance. I'll just pick that up. I mean, it's a real balancing act. It's like being on a tightrope and you're just trying to keep everything together. And I really do think, you know, mental health is a managing process. You can't just sort of click your fingers and everything kind of is okay again. It is a constant management. And Pat and I, you know, we have periods where we're absolutely fine, where we're doing really well, but then there'll be something that is just a curveball that's thrown at us. As you say, work might get on top of us. And so you have to go back to basics and really try to do the things that help you. I know, Pat, you know, sport I mentioned before, but keeping active is something I know is really important for you.
Yeah, true. I also think being a parent is a tricky one for health, because picking up, Sandy, and your point earlier that you were saying about the expectations on men, I think there's an expectation on dads to be super dads, which wasn't so much. I had a very good dad, I'll say that now, but he definitely wasn't doing as much as I see modern dads doing in the park every Saturday and spending a lot more time with children. And it's expected, I think, more now, and doing more housework. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying there's definitely more expectation to be perfect dad and perfect house husband as well. That probably wasn't there so much in the past.
I was thinking the same thing, Pat, actually, because, you know, our parents are similar sort of, you know, kind of age, and it was very clearly divided then between what, you know, the male role and the female role. Now, both Patrick and I, I'm sure we wouldn't want it any other way. We have a really strong kind of, you know, close relationships with our kids. But I guess it's what women have faced for many a years. You know, we are pulled in a lot of different directions, and it's just adds to that pressure, I guess.
It's such a difficult one, isn't it? And I think it's very, so, I mean, for context, I don't have kids myself, so it's not necessarily something I can relate to, but obviously I have a father, and I've got friends now who are fathers and stuff. And like you said, Pat, they are coming into this world where everything is kind of very different, and kind of looking for a way to manage that, but also a way to, like, I guess it's like being a good example when you feel like you don't have your own stuff together at the same time. And I think, I guess it's like social media, you know, there's so much comparison now, know, among everyone. And it's so easy to look at whether it's celebrities or other people in your life, and they look like they've somehow got all of this together, and they're also raising these perfect children and everything like that. What's that been like? And when you guys were kind of researching for the book and having these conversations with all these other men, and, you know, them kind of giving their stories, how much did kind of the rise of, I suppose, like social media and that kind of thing? I mean, it's such a huge topic, and especially something for, you know, for us at Pitstop, and we find so many people get into it. How much did you find that kind of coming out in the stories of men saying that had been a part of their kind of journey with their kind of mental health.
I'll come back to that in a second. I just want to make a point, though, that although there are these expectations, extra expectations on being the perfect dad, perfect husband, and you know, worker and such like, these kind of different roles we have to play. Actually, there is out there some modelling of people who don't get it right and who actually have had difficulty. You know, we've had, you know, whether it's Prince William and Harry and some of the rugby players, you know, The Rock. So there are people actually modelling vulnerability, which we never had. I mean, you know, our parents wouldn't have shown any emotion. My dad didn't show any emotion at all. No. I saw my dad cry once, and that was when the cat died. And then literally, you know, you just don't, because that wasn't the way they did it. And so I think in that respect, maybe it's changing a little bit in terms of there are people who are showing that kind of vulnerability. But in terms of social media, yeah, it's pervasive. It does come out. And I think it came out in the stories, particularly when people talk about becoming present and using mindfulness or prayer or something to actually kind of ground themselves in the present rather than being always on, always, you know, on the go with the digital, which is difficult to switch off. So I think that's how I saw it coming out in terms of, plus the comparison, as you say, you know, everyone, you know, reminding yourself that social media isn't reality, really. What would you say for that?
Sandy or me?
Pat, sorry.
I don't know. I just think a lot of the people we interviewed for the book were perhaps in a certain age demographic that perhaps I think the modern generation definitely are a lot more swayed on being on phones and iPads. I still don't even know how to get on Instagram, but the older generation, e.g. my age and older, I think, yes, they're a bit less influenced because they've had a longer part of their life not being on it. Whereas I think looking at my daughters and definitely the generation above that, and maybe you, Sandy, as well, I don't know how old you are, but that, you know, your whole world probably is Facebook, Instagram, blah, 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 social media. I'm still a bit of a Stone Age man on that. But I do think that, yeah, I mean, it's definitely made even dating and things like that. I think I see a lot of younger guys who it's not the same old way of meeting someone in the bar. It's obviously all this swipe left, right profiles. Again, having to look amazing on your image, keep up that reputation with your friends. I think that's probably a lot harder than rocking up in a bar and just chatting to someone. And
Yeah, definitely. I would say that it is very different from when we were kind of, you know, growing up. But, you know, I wrote a blog on this quite recently in terms of, I was asked to write a blog on how to stay sort of mentally healthy on social media. And my first line was, you know, the best way to stay mentally healthy is to close all your apps and don't swipe, snap or post again, really, because I do think it does have an impact. But at the same time, a lot of us don't have the luxury of doing that, particularly if you're working in it. So I think just being conscious and being aware of the relationship you have with social media. You know, why are you posting about that amazing holiday? You know, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to get external validation from outside? Yeah. Or is it, you know, and so I guess it's being more conscious and mindful of it. But yeah, it's certainly something that we need to navigate, but our children will need to navigate even more.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It is a really interesting one. Sorry, Pat. Yeah, go.
Yeah, no, this is nothing to do with what we're talking about, but kind of is. For example, today I went into Halfords to get a lock for my bike. And I was just talking to the man. I said, "Look, I've got to get back for this podcast." And he said, "Oh, what's the podcast on?" So I started talking about that. And I said, "Mental health." And he goes, "Oh, actually, two of the guys in Halfords are off, were sick with mental health issues right now. Can you bring in a copy of the book?" I said, "Yeah." But I wasn't expecting, and he was very open about it. Like, so I think the message is getting crossed, but it's just everywhere, isn't it? Every walk of life, and I was thinking, Halfords, that can't be that stressful, but obviously it is. You never know.
That's a really interesting as well, isn't it? Because it, like you said, that's not necessarily what you'd expect. You know, your typical response when you mention something about mental health is people kind of shy away and they go, "Ooh, we can't talk about that." You know, let's sweep that under the carpet and, you know, let's not do it. But like you guys said at the very start of the podcast, I think The thing that what gets through for men that is perhaps different for women is just sitting down one-to-one and looking at each other and having a conversation. I think there was a study done, wasn't there, that when you're not actually looking at the person, it's why they say apparently going for a walk or taking a drive is actually more effective for getting people to open up, right? Because it doesn't feel as intense, you know? I don't know why it is, whether it's ingrained in us because of, you know, ancestry and all that. But as men, it's not like we just sit down and go, yeah, cool, I'll just spill all this. So it's really interesting that, I mean, it's clearly things, as you said, are changing. But, you know, but ultimately as well, I think a lot of the time it's what you said there, Fabian, that you use that word validation. And I think we're so worried as men that by talking about what's going on, even if it's the smallest, it may seem to you like a really small issue. But once it's out there and gone, you go, right, well, people are going to think I'm really stupid for this. But actually, when you realize that just X amount of other men are thinking the exact same thing as you, suddenly that's positive validation, right? That's when you go, oh, do you know what? Actually, and I think that's exactly what your book does so well. And I'd love to know whether, you know, your own personal stories of hearing these guys feel that validation and kind of that realization of like, oh, I'm not alone. Because I feel anxious when I leave the house, or going to the supermarket makes me feel like I'm going to have a panic attack because of something that happened to me, or, you know, any of these other kind of stories that you guys have in the book.
Fabian, I hope you don't mind me saying about this, but I think when we came up with the ideas, like I remember sitting in a doctor's appointment, and I'd lost loads and loads of weight, so I was really thin and not happy, and I had no idea what was going on basically in my life. I thought I had cancer or something crazy like that, and I was in the doctor's appointment, and I remember thinking, if only I'd known then that lots and lots of people are on medication, lots of people suffer from stress. I was only in my 20s. And I kind of thought that was the idea behind the book. If only there was something in a doctor's surgery or just some way of knowing that actually loads of people are dealing with the same thing. So I felt very alone on my own. I remember emailing Fabian and he basically emailed back his story, and his story had a great effect on me because I thought, how did I not know he was in that bad a place? And I'd been out with him and, you know, he knew the date, et cetera, et cetera. But I was also thinking like, this has been helpful writing it. I think Fabian would agree that actually it was quite, the word, Fabian, you know the word, therapeutic. Writing the stuff actually helped release some of it from me. And I think Fabian, that won't be for every man because not everyone likes writing and, you know, expressing stuff. But I think Fabian would agree. We both got, and so I think I've had some feedback from some of the guys that wrote in the book, and I'm sure Fabian will echo this, that for them it was just enough writing their story and getting it out. You know, great if it helps others, but for them it also helped them writing it and expressing it.
Yeah, I think you've really kind of summed that up really nicely, Pat, because I think that sense of being alone, it is this weird thing where, you know, there are so many people going through the similar thing, but we're all being silent about it and we're all keeping it locked inside our head, I guess because of a shame maybe, or a kind of, you know, self sort of stigmatizing. I remember going out with a group of friends from university, and, you know, we would just, it'd always be banter, be always like cracking the jokes and talking about football maybe. And I remember I wasn't drinking because I was on medication at the time. And I said that, you know, and yeah, I guess it's a bit of a risk to be able to maybe, but I said that. And I remember one of the guys came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I'm on medication as well. And, you know, it's really great that you can be so open about it. And I think it gets to a point where, you know, you've suffered enough and you need to share it. And I think, you know, the real theme in the book, this Big Boys Don't Cry book that we put together, was you're not alone and it's, you need to talk about it. It's good to talk about it and it can really help. So I think those are the two things that I really took away from it.
I think the other good thing about the book was there's, my own issue was anxiety. Fabian's different, maybe slightly different to mine, but everyone had a different story. But some were common, but, you know, had like PTSD and stuff that I didn't really know much about. I know they all seem kind of similar, but they're all very uniquely different. So that was interesting, the variety of stories and people, and also the variety of backgrounds of people can, as Fabian put it very nicely, what was your phrase? It's in, mental health is not, you had a quote now, I've got it.
It doesn't discriminate.
Yeah, he's the wordsmith. So basically, yeah, exactly that. And we had like lawyers to the lollipop man, et cetera, different backgrounds, different races. So I found that interesting as well, that it just doesn't matter who you are, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's all too common and we've seen it way too many times, all these incredibly famous, successful, from the outside, extremely happy people that have, men that have then gone on to kind of take their own lives, you know, Robin Williams, Chester Bennington, the lead singer of Linkin Park, like these super high profile guys that from the outside, like you said, Pat, they look like they've got everything. And they, you know, to the outside, you go, nah, these guys are absolutely fine. And then you know, it comes down to actually what's behind it. And sadly, you know, it was too late for them.
Yeah.
Fabian,
yeah,
something
there's
I
reason
really...
why, you know, men are... Sorry, you broke up a little bit there, Sandy, but finish what you're saying.
No, I was going to carry on. So, please go. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to make the point that it's a reason why, you know, three times as many men take their own lives as women, you know, and it's been like that since the 1990s. And, you know, this idea of the strong silent type, I guess, you know, and we've seen it quite recently and, you know, maybe too early to talk about it. But, you know, Liam Payne as well looks like it might have been a suicide. And, you know, they men tend to take more violent sort of means. And, you know, I guess it's kind of, you know, thankfully I was able to, you know, talk openly, you know, so my presenting issues at the time were kind of, you know, depression, anxiety and, you know, suicide ideation. And that's something I lived with for quite a while before I was able to talk about it. And I going back to the point we were talking about before, I had a lot of friends, you know, we were a close kind of school kind of network, but I didn't feel I could reach out to any of them. Because I hadn't had that kind of conversation before. And it gets to the point was, what is the point of having friends if you can't talk to them openly, if you can't have that authentic conversation? And I know it's difficult, but I'm so glad that, you know, both Patrick and I we're much more genuine and authentic. And I think that comes out in all our relationships, really, because you're not hiding behind a mask.
Mm. I mean, there is by opening up, I would say the only negative is that I remember when the book came out, my neighbours were like always asking every 5 minutes, are you okay? Are you all right? Are you okay? And that can be really irritating because actually I was absolutely fine. So it's just, you know, sometimes being reminded of it can make you go back to those places because I don't know about Fabian, once I'm out of my bad spells, I'm back to my normal irritating, as my wife would say, self. But yeah, the other thing I wanted to mention briefly, if it's all right, Sandy, can you?
Yeah, of course. Hear me?
Yeah,
of course.
Oh, yeah, it's... recently, I was diagnosed with ADHD, which didn't surprise anyone. And I think there's a lot of people, again, from maybe 40s plus, that all this neurodiversity and all the autism and ADHD is not something that was ever clocked. Mm-hmm. So there are some, you know, neurodiverse brain stuff that does also link with depression, anxiety, and Fabian know a lot more than this as a counsellor. But I think for me, having that diagnosis was helpful because it kind of explained a lot of passage in my life, but also learning strategies to try and not be overwhelmed or do too much or get burnt out. But even people without ADHD in the modern world, it is very consuming from every angle, isn't it? As we said earlier. So there are some lessons that Fabian definitely could talk about in his life that he, I think, has put up barriers, which I've been impressed by to help him. I don't know if you want to say about that, Fabian.
Yeah, I mean, I went to a conference earlier this year and there was this stat by this Danish pilot which blew my mind. He said that, you know, the fact that how much our lives are different today as it was in the past, but we've still got the kind of same sort of hardware, same kind of brain. And he said that we receive as much information in a day today as our ancestors 700 years ago received in a lifetime. And I think this kind of overload of information, you know, that we're all getting and we're trying to catch up with it, the speed of things. And I think that can really, can lead to a lot of issues. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for me, it's kind of, again, being aware if I'm using social media too much, if it's impacting on my sleep, I can, you know, I can see when my sleep is degenerating. I will put limits on my apps, you know, I'll put limits on my social media, for example. And I'll just go back to the basics. For me, things like mindfulness, things like exercise, sleep. You know, you talked about it with Emmett, this kind of holistic approach. And I think it's so key to, yeah, look after yourself and actually, you know, put yourself first sometimes. And I think sometimes we put others first, which can lead to, yeah, a lot of issues.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think we also end up a big problem, and this is a huge problem, I think, within the larger space, is so often people wait until they hit rock bottom. Or someone else in their life has hit rock bottom before choosing to do anything about it. And I think, like you said, Fabian, I think one, I and I'm no expert at all in the slightest, but I think once you have these mental health, you know, whether you've suffered with depression, anxiety, anything like that, I'm not sure it ever truly completely goes away. I think a lot of it, I think a lot of it comes down to, like you said there, Fabian, putting in structures and strategies into your daily life to ensure that you can manage it on a better case. There's also medication, which I'd really like to get onto in a minute, Fabian, because I know you talked about that really openly in your story in the book. But before that, yeah, it is this idea of like everyone has to hit rock bottom, or there has to be this huge tragedy before a person or a group or, you know, relatives or anything go, right, actually, no, this is serious. Let's do something about this. Is there anything, you know, from your experience with the book or anything like that, what can we do to make sure that that intervention happens earlier before someone hits rock bottom or, sadly, before a tragedy takes place?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is kind of awareness, normalizing conversations around, you know, mental health and suicide prevention in particular, asking those questions. I mean, kind of having an invitation, allowing people, you know, inviting people to open up, you know, not forcing them to, but certainly, you know, asking the question, you know, are you feeling suicidal? If you are noticing someone who has having a different kind of behavioral change, or if they're withdrawing or isolating, you know, asking the question won't make someone take their own lives. It won't make it more likely. In fact, it's the opposite. There's no science or evidence to suggest that it will make someone take their own life. And we don't ask the question because of embarrassment, because we're worried that we might upset someone. But ultimately, we need to ask that question. And I know from personally, I was waiting for someone when I was feeling suicidal. I was waiting for someone to ask me to pick up the signs. You know, the signs were there. They were quite subtle, but they were there. And, you know, and just being kind of persistent and being just there and around. And I think that's what Patrick and I are for each other now. We are there. You know, if someone is going through a difficult time, we'll just check in, that text going, you know, just checking in, everything's okay. And so it's an invitation. So when someone's ready to open up, they will do. And I think that's what's going to help prevent the tragedies.
I think also Fabian said a good point, because obviously when he was going through his bad period, I didn't pick up on it. But the masking, men are experts at masking, aren't they? We can all mask. And one thing, practical thing, and I know, yeah, it's easy for me to say because I'm sporty, but I set up a running group. I used to run on my own, but that was depressing in itself. So it was, started being sociable. I got other men on my street or nearby to run. So we started running together. And these are the same people that were dads at my daughter's school who were sitting in a pub week in week, say nothing, just be suspicious of each other and say nothing. But as soon as we start running together, every week they've really opened up. And, you know, they'll tell you you've had a crap week or had an argument with their wife. And I feel like now because of the running, they're very open. You've got the space to kind of check. And it's kind of a checking up on each other just by running once a week. We do it every Sunday, have a coffee at the end. And that's more effective. So I think like the men share, it doesn't have to be sport, whatever it is, music, whatever your passion is, to have a group of men that you regularly do stuff. Because I think for me, when I was younger, I had sports teams. And in those teams, you might go tours and you do this. As soon as that disappears in later life, what is there? There's your work colleagues you're not going to say anything to because you're worried you lose your job. Not many people have groups, do they? They can, of men only, they can sort of open up to.
I think there's that idea as well. That's like a really interesting point. I think there's this whole thing that once you become an adult, the play has to stop. And sadly, a lot of the time for men, that means that sport or that activity or that thing that you have loved since you were a child up until the age of 18, maybe even your early 20s, that disappears because it's like, now it's time to get the job and have the family and buy the house and do all this stuff. And that's what we were saying at the start of the episode, where as soon as that falls off, suddenly your entire self-worth is tied to your career or your family or your net worth. And actually, like, interesting, Pat, for me as well, I'm hugely sporty as well. And I think I read something recently about this. You should decentralize your self-worth. So you should attach it to various different things so that when one falls off a cliff or goes a bit shit, you realize actually, well, that's okay, because I still did a personal best running the other day. Or I still had a great session in the gym. Or if that's going off, oh well, I still had a great day at work, you know, or I still had a great time with my family the other day. So it's that idea. And I think, going back to my original point, I think that is a big problem for men, especially because we love our interests and our hobbies and we love tinkering and whether it's building Lego or playing golf or going surfing or going running or anything like that, or sport, a hobby. So many of us stop doing that in our 20s and we don't pick it up again until we've retired. And by then our bodies don't work and it's too late for us to get into it, really.
No,
and then all you do is yearn for it. So I think it's so important for men to keep having those interests and those passions and carve out time for it and realize that it's just as productive to go running as it is to sit there and focus on your side hustle to make more money or, you know, anything like that. It's so important to have those hobbies, or it certainly has been for me anyway.
I totally agree. And just on that note, Sandy, do you support a football team at all?
I don't. No, I'm not. I'm not a football guy at all. Yeah, yeah.
We're about to fall out over that. That's
we can stay friends. Yeah.
Okay.
But that's a good point as well. That kind of tribalism aspect of that. It's so easy for us to demonize this whole like football lad culture. You should be doing it and all this. And actually, I think there's a lot of really healthy. Of course, yeah, I don't condone the violence and all that, but I think there's a lot of really healthy aspects to that side of football and people finding their tribe through a shared love of something. I think is so important.
I agree.
Just picking up on what you were saying before about kind of having, you know, like your personal best, Sandy, and that, I think those kind of small wins when you're in a low place can really help. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, when you're depressed and you it's hard to get out of bed, as I found myself, you know, those years ago, just, you know, getting up, having a shower, getting dressed, going for a walk, you know, just giving yourself the credit for that is huge. And I think, you know, don't underestimate how complicated life can be sometimes, you know, when you're at the checkout or whatever, and someone's asking you about a million questions, you know, have you got a loyalty card, and you're kind of just overwhelmed. So it is, you know, when you're in a place and your world is kind of narrowed, just doing those small wins, getting through the day, looking at the next half hour. That's what someone said to me. Just look at the next half hour when you're absolutely racked with anxiety and you're just worrying and it's just spiraling and you're worried about the next, just the next half hour, just get through the next half hour. And that really helped me at the time.
I love that. That's so cool. Fabian, something I really wanted to get onto, you know, I kind of read through a few of the stories, including both of your personal stories. And I want to start with you, Fabian. You mentioned it earlier in the episode. This whole thing about medication as a treatment for anxiety and depression, to me, it's kind of a stigma within a stigma. I think you've already got this stigma around mental health, and I'll hold my hands up as well. You know, I'll share, given that we're here and that's the whole idea of this. Like in kind of February, March this year, I basically had a bit of a breakdown. Ended up going out. I left where I was living at the time and went to be with my family. And the first thing they kind of, I don't want to say they gave me an intervention, but they sort of sat me down. Basically, my friends I was with got in touch with my family and were like, yeah, he's really not very good. And they sat me down and they were like, I think you should go on medication for a little while. And the first thing I said was like, no way, I'm not doing that. And all my past history of 4 or 5 years of talking about mental health and being so open with it, and I still felt internally this thing of like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. And I was really kind of shocked at myself for being so repulsed by the idea of it. So Fabian, I'm really interested to hear, and I'm sure so many other people will be as well, like your experience with that and how that kind of helped and what that did.
Yeah, well, thanks for sharing, Sandy. And it is, you know, I used to describe myself as having a breakdown. Now I look at it as a more of an existential crisis, I think, you know, because I think it was actually the kind of midlife crisis is a bit of a cliche. And actually, for me, it was kind of not really knowing why I was getting out of bed, you know, what is it that I was there for? And I think that's what kind of led me. But, you know, in terms of the medication, like you, I was really opposed to it. There's a bit of family history. My elder sister has bipolar, and so she was on some strong medication called lithium. And I think for me, it had a lot of associations. You know, we may have watched One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest when we were younger. And I think, you know, that was those kind of images, kind of outdated images, were in my mind. And I think previously when I'd been to the doctor, they hadn't really had much of a conversation. They just wanted to pass me off with like, get me out of the room with some meds. But the thing changed. It absolutely changed when I met a doctor who actually took the time to listen to me. We extended the session, and that's something worth remembering. You can ask for an extended session beyond the 10 minutes. So that's something that's really important, because sometimes you feel you're in and out really quickly. So do remember that. I know it's tricky, but you can ask for longer than 10 minutes. And this doctor actually listened to me, and he just said, look, here are the options. You know, there is medication, there's talking therapy. And I said I was, you know, my reluctance to taking medication. And he said, you know, I completely understand that. No, you're not going to be pressured on it. But if you think about it, and I've heard this subsequently, and it must be a thing they use because I think it's quite helpful. He goes, if you were diabetic, you wouldn't think twice about using insulin. I'm asthmatic. Would you think twice about using an inhaler? Of course not. I'd use an inhaler. And I really like that kind of parity, that kind of, you know, that kind of comparing with physical illness, because, of course, we don't think twice whether it's something physical. So really, I went away. I didn't decide there and then, but I went away and I did decide to take an SSRI, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor called citalopram. And to be honest, it kind of, I was at such rock bottom that I needed something to bring me up so I could help myself with the talking therapy. I think that for me, that was the point. I was just so low. And suicidal, you know, so I really needed to bring my mood up and stabilize it. And I did have some initial kind of side effects to taking citalopram. I had, you know, something, you know, it's kind of head zaps, as I would describe it, where it was quite uncomfortable. I felt quite dizzy. And that lasted a few weeks. And then it leveled off and then it did help. When I was coming off it, again, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, the NICE guidelines were a bit out of date. So they said actually the withdrawal effect should only last 2 weeks. And for me, they lasted a lot longer when I was coming off the citalopram. So again, you know, everything comes with its strings attached, I guess. And it's such a personal choice. I wouldn't, you know, sit here and say to everyone, you should be on medication. Mm. It's such a personal choice. Weigh it up. For me, it worked for a time and then I came off it. I actually went on to another another medication called vortioxetine, which didn't have such strong side effects for me, because things like my libido would go, you know, and I'd feel a little bit numbed. So that was another side effect. So that's why I changed the medication. But ultimately, you know, I was on medication for 5 years. I came off it a year and a half ago. And if I was going through difficulty again, I'd be within a heartbeat, I'll do it again, because it really helped me at that time. So that's my experience of medication. I hope that helps.
No, for sure. I think it's really interesting. And like I said, I think the reason I was so intrigued by it is because it's a stigma within the stigma. You know, there's already the stigma about men's health and everything like that. And I consider myself a complete open book, much like you guys. You know, after your experience, I had the same thing and I'm so open and talking about this and everything. But yet when I was suddenly faced with, I think you should go on medication, my first thought was, no, I'm not doing that. I don't need that. You know, only now I can look back at it and kind of question it. You know, in the time it's so difficult, but you know, with hindsight now, it's been a really interesting one. Pat, on the other side, you had a bit of a different journey. You mentioned earlier, you know, anxiety was like a big thing for you everything. And then actually it wasn't necessarily medication, but it was actually faith that kind of, you know, got you through it and everything.
This is my chance to preach. Have I got an open forum?
It'd just be cool to, because again, this is something so for me, like I'm not religious at all or anything like that. And I think it's, again, it's kind of curiosity out more than anything else. But can you kind of speak to your experience and how that helped you through?
Yeah, I can. But also I was going to say, because this is an interesting topic itself, I went to church recently and they were talking about, and I'm not going to say any names because it's a very sensitive area, but there are some Christians that committed suicide, which is obviously a really interesting one, because if in the, you know, some people believe that's not a Christian way of doing things. But however, it was preached very well actually about how that's not true, because God does forgive and understand when someone's at that rock bottom. But I found that very interesting, because it's a bit of an oxymoron for a Christian to commit suicide, because, you know, you're meant to have a faith in someone higher and you know what, you shouldn't be taking your own life. It's precious from God, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I do think, having known, like Fabian, getting to very low points, how easily that could happen. Mm-hmm. So I will answer the question. I've gone a bit of a sidetrack, but I do sort of think, for me, the positives of faith is that obviously I could pray. Fabian mentioned mindfulness, other things. You know, I'm a Christian, so that is my faith. So that helped me, and having people pray for me, having people encourage me, having knowing that there was something beyond me. Because I think Fabian may not agree with this, you may not agree, but far set anyway, is that sometimes when people are in these low states, and I've got family members who have it, you can be a bit self-obsessed. I was. All you can think about is yourself all the time, right? And someone else can tell you something really tragic, and I just had no compassion. I was just like, not interested. It's not about me. I'm not going to get better if I hear this. So I became very, if you like, un-Christian, very selfish when I was, just to survive. I think it's survival, isn't it? And then I'm thinking, well, I'm meant to be this loving Christian guy who doesn't give a damn basically about anyone except myself. And you can get into a very dark spiral. And sometimes for me, knowing that there's a God outside of that and a bigger picture than me can bring you out. And that doesn't have to necessarily be Christianity. It might be another faith. But for me, having a faith was very, very important, that I'm not the be all and end all, but I am created for a reason. And famous saying about this, not, well, I've never doubted there's a reason being here, but you know, that some people would have that. Why are we here? What are we doing there? I kind of knew that. So that kind of helped.
Yeah.
And that there was a positive light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm. Yeah.
But I do want to emphasize this. It didn't make it any easier than Fabian's experience or anyone else's. I just had a faith that supported me through it. But it was still really bad.
Yeah, absolutely. I think something really interesting to point on is, and like, I think it's so awesome that you now have that self-awareness to look back and be like, and I hate to say it, like, it is a bit of a tough pill to swallow for so many people, but like, when you are depressed or feeling like this, like, you are kind of selfish. And I think that is inherently one of the problems, is because of the way you behave like that, you do kind of end up pushing people away. And I think that's one of the things for like to put out there is like, sometimes when people are being like that, like, it sucks, but you've kind of just got to realize that it's not necessarily their fault. You know, it's like a symptom, if anything. And I think I love that to counteract that, I think a huge part of it, and I'm a huge believer of this as well, is realizing, I mean, I put it in the context of nobody is thinking about you as much as you think they are. You know, it's just like your problems are the most important problems in the world to you.
Yes.
To the world, or you know, the way you see it in a religious way, Pat, or the way for example, the way I see it is, I do a lot of water sports and stuff, so every time I go in the ocean, I'm like, the ocean doesn't give a shit about me. So you know, it's so vast and broad and massive, and you know, you're like, when you can put that into context, you actually realize, and in a way, like, realizing how insignificant you are is actually a bit of a superpower, I think.
Oh yeah, blessing.
And I think it really does help you realize and kind of rationalize your own thoughts and feelings, and realize, okay, actually, I can get on top of this. You know, it looks like such a mountain in front of you, but when you realize the grand scheme of things, and that's not to say you have to invalidate how you feel, because I think a lot of people also do that, and men especially do that, I think, where they go, no, my thoughts and feelings don't matter. Again, it's one of those things that it's always a balance. But I really like what you said there, Pat, about how you know, realizing you're part of a bigger thing. I think it's so important.
And just really quickly, and I'll let Fabian, because he's more of an expert on this than me, but I think Fabian will say about the volunteering and doing stuff outside of yourself is a good process to recovery. Is that right, Fabian?
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of one of those five ways to well-being. It's, you know, giving and is one of those key ones. If you look up five ways to well-being on Google that, it will kind of give you those kind of foundations. So yeah, giving certainly. But I think you can really only do that when you're in a good place, in a way. You need to be at a certain place. And I think it's really interesting what you said, Sandy. It really helped me to know that, you know, you don't have to be important. You don't have to be special. Your name doesn't have to be up in lights to be of value. You know, no one's going to remember us in 100 years. Of course, this podcast will still be going, of course. But the reality is that, you know, most of us won't live on, you know, won't be remembered in 100, 200 years or so. So for me, that took the pressure off, you know, the fact that just being fulfilled and content. You don't need to be super happy all the time. You don't need to be materially sort of wealthy and successful, you know, and that's why I think, you know, things like faith can really help, because it's spiritual rather than material. And that did come out in the book, you know, that was in our top 10 of tips that we gathered from the men's stories. I just pick up on one thing, Pat, you said, and this is just to kind of educate us all, actually. Committing suicide is quite an outdated way of saying it, actually.
It's
linked to, we say it all the time because it just trips off our tongues, but it's kind of linked to the kind of more criminalization of suicide when it was a criminal offence. So you said afterwards, taking your own life, that's kind of a way, or die by suicide. It's just... It kind of helps take away the shame and the stigma a little bit, if we can express it like that. But something that it's getting used to doing.
I think it's, yeah, I mean, it's such an important, I mean, first of all, yeah, I mean, it's one of those difficult ones. It's never an easy thing to talk about, is it? You know, these kind of ways of saying it. One thing as well from the book that I kind of wanted to get into, this was one of the other stories. I think it was Gregory. He said, one of the big things that he said in his one was vulnerability is strength. Mm. And I do completely agree with that. And I think it's a really good sentiment. But I think a lot of men read that and go, yeah, I'm sure it is, but how do I get there? You know, and I think that is such a big thing. You know, vulnerability isn't strength when you first are vulnerable. Do you know what I mean? Vulnerability becomes strength when you start to own it. And when you've got everybody around you going, yes, this is good. But when you first sit there and break down in front of someone and tell them finally what your brain is doing to you and how you're feeling, that's not a strong place to be. It's literally the polar opposite. The definition of vulnerability is at the opposite of strength. So I think it's a really good term, but I think it's something that needs to be built up towards. To kind of start to wrap up, what kind of steps can people really kind of put in place to start getting to that point where they can own their vulnerability and they can feel like that is a strength?
I mean, Gregory was a mixed martial arts, practitioner, as if I remember rightly. So he had really gone through it, and he really hadn't cried at all. And then it was when he actually did cry, he didn't stop crying because he really got to that point. And I think it comes back to what you were saying, Sandy, right at the beginning. You know, it is that not getting to that break, you know, to that absolute low point, trying to build in practices, which is a lot of what Pit Stop's about, actually trying to educate and actually putting in that holistic kind of view actually and practices, so you know, to keep yourself healthy so you don't get to that point. So that could be exercise, we've talked about it, could be a mindfulness practice, faith. I think the relationship we have with ourselves is so fundamental, actually being aware of that inner critic who's just absolutely beating you on the head and just saying you're rubbish, you're shit, you know, and this is what I was doing all the time, like in the monologue. And so actually having a bit more self-compassion, more self-acceptance, and owning your own story, and I think is really key. And actually, the old saying of putting on your oxygen mask on first before helping others. You know, if we can have a good relationship with yourself, you're going to be a much better husband, friend, you know, partner, whatever. So I think building in those practices, you know, and all the great stuff that, you know, Pit Stop is advocating. I read the article about imposter syndrome recently, and I think it's just that awareness, self-awareness, I think is really key. Pat, I don't know what your thoughts are.
Mine's very simple and quick. Is that I think in the world where Sandy was saying earlier about the social media and everyone trying to be, it's a very I world, isn't it? You know, like, what am I doing? What am I up to? Reaching out and being a bit more, making sure you've got good friends. Not an online friend, an actual real friend, outside of your wife, outside of your girlfriend, or whatever, actual other blokes. That when the S hits the F, as they say, you actually got someone to actually physically see. And Fabian, I'm sure you'll agree, and I'm sure you'll agree, Sandy, that in the bad times, you realise who your really good mates are, because they'll be hanging around. And if they're good enough mates, they'll be checking up on you before anyway and seeing how you are and where you're at. But get out with the positive, good mates. And find them before it's too late.
That reminded me, Pat. There was a advice from someone to get rid of the drains in your life and try to get more radiators. So the people who drain
you. We tried to get rid of each other. We just didn't manage it, Fabian. After that table, when I beat you at table tennis, obviously, no, you're beating me. Anyway,
we need a rematch.
We do.
To kind of wrap up, guys, just one more little story. I think it was Twitch's story. He talked about these grounding techniques, and I'd love to get Pat. I know, especially for you, your story was especially like anxiety focused as well. And for me, I suffer really badly with anxiety, and for anyone who's listening, I'm holding up AirPods. These are my grounding things. I've got them in my ears at the moment. I carry these with me at all times, and I have like, I literally have a playlist on Spotify. As soon as I start, my hands start like. I start like doing this, and that's when I know I'm panic attacks, symptoms are starting and I get hot and I'm like, right. So I put my headphones in. So that's kind of my grounding technique. But his ones was like actually asking these three questions. So it was, where am I? Am I safe? And what am I going to do next? And that was something that really, really resonated with me as someone who has suffered with anxiety. And I wonder if just quickly before we finish, both of you could kind of, but Pat, you first, like speak to any grounding techniques that you guys use and what your thoughts were on those three kind of questions to ask yourself.
Wow. So the question's great. I've tried pretty much everything at some stage, and I'm not ranting on about the ADHD, but ADHD does make you bored and forget things quickly and jump from thing to thing. So I've pretty tried everything. And one thing, there was this sort of, I can't remember what it's called, I'm terrible at names, but the one where you sort of tapping different parts of your body. And that was all right. It distracted me from anxiety, but I don't know if it actually did much. I've done acupuncture, lots of physical things to try and calm me down. There's lots of things with gripping your hand and opening it slowly and all this. There's millions of things. I don't know if, for me personally, one particular one of these physical things worked. I think probably a combination of a lot of them over time did help as part of a bigger picture of lots of other things.
Yeah, I think Pat sort of touched on something really important. You know, you need to find what works for you. You need to have as many tools in your, you know, toolbox, as many weapons in your armory. And it's kind of one, what works for one person won't work for you. So it is kind of, you know, really looking at what, you know, what's going to resonate. I mean, I have trained as a counsellor, and I do use these grounding techniques myself and with my clients. And I think there are some really good ones. Twitch actually served in Basra. He was ex-army. And so he would have, I think he had post-traumatic stress disorder. Yeah. So he really would have had these grounding techniques to really avoid those kind of flashbacks or try to counter those. And for me, I mean, there are lots of ones. The five senses is something that's a really good one, where you use your senses to ground you. So if you look up five senses on Google, it will grounding technique. But for me, there's one that's really rooted in neuroscience, and I'll end with this one. And it's basically trying to tap into your parasympathetic kind of rest and digest system. And it's really activating something called the vagus nerve. And it's really what you're trying to do. You can do it in 3 minutes. So if you're nervous or anxious at work, just go to the toilet or just get outside. And what you want to do is breathe in through your nose for about 4 seconds. Hold for 1 second, and then breathe out through your mouth for 6 seconds, or at least longer than when you're breathing in. And if you can do it blowing out through kind of pursed lips, as though you're blowing through a straw or blowing on a hot drink, that action will activate the vagus nerve, and it's amazing. It will calm you down in minutes. And so I use that one so often, and I would really recommend people finding some sort of grounding technique that helps them, particularly if they suffer from anxiety or panic attack.
Yeah, absolutely. Guys, well, thank you so much. I mean, there's so much good advice in there. So many things that hopefully other people listening to this can kind of relate to. If anyone wants to check out the book and find out more about, you know, everything around that, where can they go?
Media Man.
Go on to bigboysdon'tcry.co.uk. The website's there, and I'll have our details. You can email us on bigboysdon'tcrybook@gmail.com. To be honest, we just want the book to go out there. So we do have paperback copies available for £10. But if you want a copy, or someone's in need of a copy of the ebook, you know, we'll just send that for you for free. So we want people to feel less alone. We want to help people. We want to share our stories. Let's get in touch.
And some of the money goes to two charities, isn't it, Fabian?
They do. Yeah, we've got Calm, Campaign Against Living Miserably, and a really good charity called Sport and Mind. Both of them doing lots of work, great work for mental health charities. So, 10% of the proceeds will go to those charities.
Yeah, awesome. Well, guys, thank you so much. I highly recommend everyone coming on. Everyone giving the book a read. You know, it's really powerful, and it makes you realize that you're not alone with whatever's going on in your head. Thank you, Fabian. Thank you, Patrick.
No problem.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much to all you guys for listening. And we will see you for the next one.